This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It is episode 30, and I'm actually on day 14 of the 21-day challenge for going 21 days straight without complaining, criticizing, or gossiping. I will have to admit that I have given myself a little grace on a couple of occasions. Because when I first started doing this, of course, I was towing a really tight line. And then I got to thinking, you know, you can create an environment of failure for yourself sometimes by just making a ridiculous requirement. And so I have given myself a little bit of grace on some things that maybe I wouldn't have before. I got tickled at myself last night. I think it was last night. I had gotten home and I was working on some things, and a thought came up in my mind that we were having this same problem again. You know, I was having this thought in my mind. I hadn't said anything out loud. And as I got to the again part, my mouth came open and I went, and then I realized, wait a minute, hold it back up. And I actually, I had sort of started to say it, but then I thought, you know what? I didn't even say it. Okay, let's not get ridiculous about this. So I'm still on day 14, and that was day 13 yesterday. Today's 14. So as long as I don't have some major meltdown in the next 7 days, I think I will at least have been through my first 21-day period of no complaining, no gossiping, no criticizing, with a little grace. And then maybe we'll see. After that, I'll loop around and maybe kind of tighten down a little bit and make a second run at it. Sometimes you need a little encouragement to, you know, make it through the first time. Anyways, it is episode 30. As I said before, today's topic is fractals. I love the fractals. I've loved fractals for a long time. Happened to see a program on Nova a couple of months ago now, I think. And when I saw the program, I went, oh yeah, I gotta talk about that on the podcast. And then some other things kind of intruded, and I didn't feel like it was quite the right time yet. And then this last week, sometime in the since I did the last podcast, I think, I came across an article. I'm still just a little stopped up, but I'm getting there. Came across an article, and when I read that article, I started laughing and said, okay, yeah, it's time to do the talk on fractals. But in order to get to the impact of that article, I really have to kind of back up and lay a foundation a little bit for fractals and what they are and how they work. I am not an expert. I'll just tell you that right off the bat. I love mathematics, but I really don't have that much training in mathematics. But I will explain this as best as I am able from a perspective that I think will get us to the punchline at the end. So let's back up a bit. Prior to about 30 years ago, in the olden days, there were areas of investigation that didn't seem to have much connection to each other. For instance, mathematics didn't really seem to have much connection to biology or living organic systems. Because with mathematics, you had on one side people, especially in geometry, people who were dealing with points and circles and lines and squares and duodecahedrons and all those type of things. And they were very neat and clean and had very pristine edges and everything's great. And then you had things like trees and ferns and blood vessels and things that really were a whole lot more difficult to describe mathematically and specifically using formulas in geometry than nice, neat circles and squares and triangles and those types of things. And on this NOVA program, one of the scientists actually said, he said, you know, there just didn't really seem to be any connection per se between mathematics and these living complex systems in terms of modeling them. Then this guy comes along, and I hope I have his first name right. Benoit Mandelbrot. And he comes along, and he comes up with this whole other idea of how to look at things. And his idea is that instead of trying to describe the entire surface of a thing mathematically, why don't you try to imagine what it took to produce that? And specifically, what he was doing is he was actually working in the early days at IBM, and so he had access to a fairly significant amount of computing power. And so he was playing with these formulas where he would put in a number and another number would come out, and he'd plot that number, and then he'd take that number and put it back into the formula and plot another number and take that number, put it back into the formula. And he was able to do this millions and millions of times very quickly because he had these computing machines. Mathematicians had been playing with these type of formulas and been trying to plot these sets of data for some time, but the problem is when you're doing it by hand or doing it with a calculator, it takes a long time. Well, Mandelbrot had access to these computers, and so he had been producing these pictures of things. The most famous thing that he produced and was published in his first book was called the Mandelbrot set. And you have probably seen it somewhere already, you just didn't know what it was called. But if you get on the web and just go to Google and just Google Mandelbrot set, M-A-N-D-E-L-B-R-O-T, Mandelbrot set. And what comes up will sort of look like kind of a black beetle. And it's got all these little bumps and edges on it, and it looks very organic. So after Mandelbrot had played with these formulas for a while, he thought this was really intriguing, and so he published a book in 1977, I think he publishes this book. And some people thought, oh, well, this is kind of interesting, and some other people said, oh, it's just pictures that he's playing with his toy computer there. And you know, some people were dismissive of it. Some people actually got it, and they were able to make it do some really useful things. One of the guys who was able to make it do some really useful things was a guy named Lauren Carpenter. At the time, Lauren Carpenter was working for Boeing Aircraft, and he was the guy who was in charge of taking the new experimental airplane designs and rendering them in a computer so that the engineers could have this pretty picture of this airplane flying through the skies. And on this NOVA program he was talking, he was saying part of the challenge that he faced was the fact that in every Boeing shot of an airplane, there's a mountain range in the back. And so he really wanted to put mountain ranges in the back. Well, now you're back to that problem of these complex shapes in nature, like mountain ranges, that are really, really hard to define in totality. Every little bump and curve and edge. Because they just didn't have the processing power to get that calculation done in any sort of a reasonable time frame. However, he happened across Mandelbrot's book. He said that he read through twice, he looked at all of the examples, and then he thought, you know, I might be able to do something with this. So he starts developing this little computer program. He said it took him about 3 days. And using Mandelbrot's principles, he starts with a couple of large triangles, different shapes and sizes. And then inside each of those triangles, he had the computer draw 3 more triangles. Just break up the space into 3 triangles that are different sizes and shapes. And then inside each one of those triangles, break it up again. And in those triangles, break them up again, and break them up again, break them up again. And he said the process is really dead simple to write. It's just very simple iterative process, it's called, because you start with one thing and then you do it again and then you do the same thing again, do the same thing again. Those are called iterations, and the whole process is called an iterative process. So he does this, takes him 3 days. He builds this little program, fires this thing up, and in no time, he's producing mountain ranges, gorgeous mountain ranges. And not just static pictures, he's producing mountain ranges that you could actually fly through in animations. And he's showing them to these colleagues, and it's, this is cool. So what looks like a very complex thing in nature, all of a sudden, through Mandelbrot's investigations and through some of his discoveries and his encouragements, this other guy is suddenly producing facsimiles of these things that look very complex, and he's doing it with this very, very simple process. This worked out quite well for Loren Carpenter, because he actually left Boeing a short time later, ended up over at George Lucas's Industrial Light and Magic, and he was the guy that put together the sequence. I think it was at the end of Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, where the Genesis planet is created. And that sequence, I think, was one of the first, if not the first, fully computer-generated sequences in a motion picture. And you can actually see this working. You know, you can just see stuff growing up, these mountains and stuff, as the computer iterates through all these triangles. So, you know, that's a pretty cool thing, and it's very useful. This endless repetition is a quality of what Mandelbrot called a fractal. And a fractal has another quality of it that comes about because of this iterations, these endless repetitions, and it's a quality of self-similarity. Because with the mountains, what you can see is that there is a general triangle shape that has other triangle shapes inside it, that has other triangle shapes inside it, with other triangle shapes inside it, with other triangle shapes inside it. And so at whatever level you look at it, whether it's the smallest level or the largest levels, you have this similar characteristic of roughness about in these mountain ranges. And you see this repeated in nature quite a bit. If you think about a fern leaf, if you just step back and you just look at the fern leaf as a whole, it has a certain shape. And then if you look at each of the individual fronds that are coming off of that fern, they're all similar. And then you go down farther and you see those all have little pieces coming off of them. And there's this quality of self-similarity. And mathematicians had actually studied shapes like this for some time. They just didn't really have a way to describe them, and they didn't really have terms for them. In fact, one of the terms that was coined for them was monsters, because there were things that just didn't make sense about them. One of these monsters was called, I think it was pronounced Coke. It's C-O-H-C, Coke snowflake. And to make a Coke snowflake, what you do is you start with an equilateral triangle, and then on each side, you break it into thirds, and the middle third you make into another equilateral triangle. So then it becomes like a Star of David. And then you go on each of those edges and you do the same thing again, and you do the same thing again. And there are animations on this on the web, and there's pictures of this, and you can see. The thing about it is you can do this infinitely many times. And so now you have an object that appears to be finite in length when you see it drawn, but in fact is infinite. And this was the kind of things that was confusing mathematicians about how can you have things that should be finite, but they're infinite, and, you know, yada, yada, yada. Well, one of the characteristics of the Koch snowflake that make it a fractal is the fact that you can look at the Koch snowflake and it has a certain roughness and a certain pattern of bumpiness, but when you zoom in on any of the points, that same roughness is still there. And Mandelbrot figured out a way of describing this roughness such that he could describe it in what he called a fractal dimension. So, okay, so it makes pretty pictures. It maybe can allow you to, you know, show how you can model something that looks like nature, but so what? All right, this is where it starts getting fun. Because several years later, there's a guy who is a radio astronomer, and he also happens to be a ham radio operator named Nathan Cohen. And Nathan Cohen has a problem. He is in an apartment complex where his landlord doesn't want him to put a big, huge ham radio antenna up on the top of his roof. So he's got a problem. So he's trying to figure out what he's going to do. He doesn't know what the solution is for this. He happens to attend a lecture by Mandelbrot. And one of the things that they talk about at the lecture is this Koch snowflake. And he said, as I was sitting there, he said, I had the thought, I wonder what it would be like to produce an antenna that had that shape, and I wonder how the antenna would do. Now, me personally, obviously I'd call that a whisper. But he decides he's going to try it. So he goes home, gets a piece of wire, and kind of draws out a rough snowflake shape, Koch snowflake shape, and he bends the wire around, and he hooks it up to his equipment. And lo and behold, if this thing doesn't work just really well, he's able to make an antenna that is smaller than the normal ham radio antenna that works just as well, and he's able to solve his problem of being able to operate his ham radio without having to put this big, huge antenna on the roof. In addition to that, he starts other investigations. And he now has a company called Fractal Antennas. And what he and others discovered was that they could build antennas using fractal principles that were smaller, that responded to a wide variety of frequencies as opposed to just being tuned to one or two frequencies. And this came along at just the right time because cell phones were coming along, and cell phones had their primary frequencies they worked on, and then they also had Bluetooth, and they might have a few other wireless things in them, and those things all operated on different frequencies, and nobody wanted to carry around a cell phone that had a bunch of stubby antennas sticking out from it, each tuned to different frequencies. But once people figured out that you could make fractal antennas, all you needed to do was make a fractal antenna, and it could perform the work of all of these other antennas combined. And in fact, Nathan Cohen, they worked out the mathematics, and they worked backward from the antenna and said, okay, why does this work? And in fact, they were able to prove, if I've got my facts straight, that the fractal design was the only design that worked like that. It wasn't just a freak that it happened to work this way. In order to get an antenna to behave like this, to respond across a wide variety of frequencies, it had to be self-similar. It had to have the qualities of fractals, as defined by Mandelbrot. Now, this is pretty interesting, because suddenly now, for me at least, this is a real-world application that works because it mimics a principle that we can see at work in nature. And in fact, when everybody was sitting around and poo-pooing Mandelbrot's work and saying, oh, it's just pretty pictures that he's gotten out of his computer, his new toy, and it really doesn't mean anything, Mandelbrot went back, I just got on my driveway, and he actually created another book. He created a subsequent book called, I've got it written down here, The Fractal Geometry of Nature. And he published that in 1982. Now that I'm on my driveway, I can actually read some of my notes better. And it was filled with examples of how his ideas could be useful to science. He argued that with fractals, he could precisely measure natural shapes, make calculations that could be applied to all kinds of formulations, from the drainage patterns of rivers to the movements of clouds. And he said on the NOVA program, if I got this right. Once you realize that a shrewd engineer would use fractals in many, many contexts, you better understand why nature, which is shrewder, uses them in many ways. And when you understand the principles of fractals and the principles of self-similarity, and you begin looking around in nature, fractals are everywhere. I mean, they're everywhere. You look at a cedar tree with the way it branches and then branches out and then branches out and then branches out. You look at ferns. You look at capillaries inside the body. You look at lungs, how lungs are the pulmonary, whatever the nodes are called on the lungs. I'm getting my mail, by the way. You look at those things. You look at something like broccoli or cauliflower, and you can see that branching pattern, how you start with this very simple formula and idea, and you just repeat it over and over and over and over and over again. And on this NOVA program, these scientists were saying, you know, this is a really great thing that nature, quote unquote, has figured out, because it takes a whole lot smaller instruction set to build something. If you can start with a simple formula, do it, and then do it over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. And what you find is that built into nature, there's fractal principles everywhere. Now then, okay, so what was the big thing this week that I found out about? I'm backing into my garage. What was the big thing this week that I found out about that made me decide, okay, it's time to do the deal on fractals? It was an article that I had read about some scientists who were investigating DNA, and specifically how DNA is stored inside the cell. For those of you who don't know, let me just give you a quick refresher on this. I'm actually in my garage, so I have to wrap this up quick. DNA is like the blueprint for your cells. So every single one of your cells has not one, but two copies of your DNA, your genome. DNA has 300 billion base pairs. The scientists have mapped it all. They don't know what it all does. Some sections, they call it junk DNA because they don't know what it does, but that may or may not be junk. They just don't know at this point. But your DNA is what helps your cells to actually build the proteins that keep you alive, because there's this little thing called an RNA transcriptive something or other, and it actually goes in and unzips the DNA, and it makes a copy of a certain sequence, and then that becomes the blueprint to make proteins and that kind of thing. And it's this very intricate process that's going on in every cell in your body all day long. It's very cool. Well, DNA is 3 billion base pairs. I was watching this little video on, I forget what the website was, but they were trying to help people understand the complexity and the size of DNA. And they had actually built a bookcase that was probably 4 feet wide, and it was a couple of feet above the narrator's head, so maybe 7 or 8 feet tall. And there was maybe 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 6 shelves of these big, fat books. And when he opened the book, there's this tiny print. I mean, it was less than 11 point. It maybe was 8, 10, 9 point, somewhere in there. Just solid, page after page after page. That was one strand of DNA. And he said, at that size, if we would just lay all of these letters end to end, it would be 3,000 kilometers long. And he said, if I would read it out loud, it would take me 100 years to get through this DNA. And yet, inside your cell, size of a pinprick, there are 2 genomes inside every single one of your cells, of which there are 100 trillion cells in your body. And even if you would take, as small as DNA is, even if you would take it and stretch it out end to end, the estimates I read is that that DNA would be approximately 2 meters, approximately 6 feet long. And yet it's all smashed together and it's down inside these little tiny spaces inside your cell. And that's the blueprint that has to be read. And scientists were trying to figure out, okay, how is that possible? What is the three-dimensional structure of DNA? They had a model that they called the equilibrium model, which as near as I could tell is basically all just smashed together. But the problem with the equilibrium model is that things would get in knots. You couldn't guarantee that the pieces of DNA that you really needed would be exposed easily. And scientists work with some very interesting techniques of imaging and freezing things and slicing and x-rays and stuff I don't understand. But they finally published their findings in Nature, I think. They finally published their findings. And in fact, Nature does not use the equilibrium model at all. In fact, Nature uses what's called a fractal globule to store this stuff. I'm looking for my notes there. And it enables the cell to pack DNA incredibly tight. According to this article, the information density in the nucleus is trillions of times, trillions with a T, trillions of times higher than on a computer chip. This is when I started laughing. All the while avoiding the knots and tangles that might interfere with the cell's ability to read its own genome. Okay, the scientists said this about this. There are no knots. It's totally unentangled. It's like an incredibly dense noodle ball that you can pull out some of the noodles and put them back in without disturbing the structure at all. And then came the statement that I was waiting for. One of the scientists said, Nature has devised a stunningly elegant solution to storing information. A super dense, knot-free structure. You know, it was one thing decades ago when the mathematicians were dealing with their straight lines and their cubes and their circles. They were all neat, nice, and tidy. And obviously the result of an intelligent mind because of how nice, neat, and tidy they were. And in those days, I would imagine there was some comfort to be able to look out and look at the world that appeared to be chaotic and random and undesigned and say, look at all that chaos out there. But if there's anything that fractals have shown us over the last several decades, is that all that out there that looked like it was just chaotic and undesigned, in fact, there are very simple, elegant equations, instruction sets that are driving all of that. And even when we need more complex instructions to build higher level living creatures, all that information couldn't function well inside the cell unless we took the same design principles, the same fractal design principles that are at work out there, and we use them internally to take this 6-foot-long string and fold it in this very precise fractal pattern so that we could store, so that it could store information at a density that is trillions of times more dense than our present-day computer chips. You can interpret that any way that you want to. For me, I see that as the hand of the master architect. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.